Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby. Joining me is Claire White.
Hello.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We are here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. And today, we are talking about just the loveliest little book and show called The Handmaid's Tale. Mm-hmm. It's not depressing at all, I promise. So, The Handmaid's Tale is the newest hit show on Hulu, which premiered on April 26, 2017. Handmaid's Tale is a lighthearted romp through a dystopian America where a puritanical regime called Gilead has taken control of the government.
Because doesn't that sound nice?
That sounds so nice. It gets nicer. Just listen up, guys. Because of toxic and nuclear waste, fertility and birth rates have plummeted in this country. And not only is it nuclear waste, it's also a mutated form of untreatable syphilis.
That'll inspire Puritans.
It totally will. Like I said, lighthearted romp. It gets even better, though. So, to combat this, the puritanical Gilead regime assigns fertile women, known as handmaids, to the elite. The elite in the government, as sex slaves and wombs with legs. The handmaid's job is to get pregnant, have the baby, then hand it over to her commander, quote-unquote, who's kind of her owner, who is her owner, to be raised by him and his barren wife. Women in Gilead have next to no rights. Handmaids themselves have no rights. Like, there's nothing. The wives have, like, a little bit. But the handmaids are just sex slaves slash baby-making slaves. The show is based off the pivotal book of the same name by Margaret Atwood. That book was published in 1985. Atwood's book has been adapted multiple times in multiple mediums, having been a movie, a play, an opera, a ballet, and now it's a successful TV show. The show stars Elizabeth Moss, Yvonne Strahovski, Joseph Fiennes, Samira Wiley, and Alexis Bledel.
You forgot to mention it's also required reading for almost any feminism class.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That makes sense, though. You had to read it, right?
I didn't have to read it. I chose to read it. I'll talk about that later.
It's actually been banned in some high schools in Texas.
Oh, I guess maybe. It's deemed anti-religion, which I don't think it is at all.
Yeah,
actually.
I can't. Actually, when we get into opinions, I'm excited to talk about that because I also don't think it's anti-religion. Anyway, Claire will be talking about the history and themes of Handmaid's Tale. I'm going to be getting into Margaret Atwood and how she came about to write this book and a bit about the show and how the show got started. So, Claire, why don't you take it away?
All right. Well, I'm going to probably delve a little bit into your segment just to, you know, start us off. But Margaret Atwood said that The Handmaid's Tale was influenced by her living in West Berlin in the early 80s and being so close to East Berlin and being constantly reminded of their presence. Like, yeah, that they would send off sonic booms every Sunday just to be like, we're here.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was also influenced by other visits she made to Soviet countries in the 80s and just how she felt like someone was always watching her and how talking to the populace, like, you were never getting the complete story. Everyone was always watching themselves. And you can totally see that in the book.
Oh, for sure. Definitely. I always wondered what it would be like to, you know, tour Poland and when it was under the Iron Curtain, you know.
You could probably go to North Korea now and get a good idea.
I don't think so. I mean, in the news, that kid just sent back.
I don't know why you would ever go to North Korea. But she said, at the time, it felt like the Soviet Union would never fall. This is the early, mid-ish 80s.
Yeah, there was a big power swing at that time.
Yeah, no one had any idea that in 89, the Iron Curtain was going to come down. Also, she was born in 1939, and she says she came to consciousness during World War II, and she was very aware that countries could vanish overnight. And World War II helped enforce that into her. And this is a quote from her New York Times interview, which I'll link to, is that it can't happen here, could never be depended on. Anything could happen anywhere, given the circumstances. And I thought that was very powerful as well.
Yeah.
And so she wrote this book about what if a totalitarian regime took over the United States and how would it happen and what would it look like? And I guess what I found really fascinating during my research was totalitarian regimes and how they seize power and what's appealing about them.
Because there's a lot of them and they've been around for a long time.
Yeah, they're kind of modern, though. And I'm going to go into this later, but they're more of a modern invention. Basically, I don't think they had the technology back then to be able to monitor everyone.
Yeah.
And it's more about ideology than anything. That's what defines a totalitarian regime.
Okay.
I based a lot of my research on Hannah Arendt's book. It's called The Origin of Totalitarianism, and she was a German-Jewish political theorist who fled Germany when Hitler rose to power, which was the very smart thing to do. And she wrote this to understand totalitarianism, and she focuses mostly on Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia. So while there are other totalitarian regimes, there were and are other ones, this is just focused on mostly Germany and the Soviet Union. But I think that her ideas actually apply to most other totalitarian regimes. And since Handmaid's Tale is influenced by Soviet Russia, I thought this was pretty appropriate.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Actually, Bruce Miller, the showrunner, in a BookCon interview, cited that book.
Yeah, it's really, I didn't read the book, but I read a lot of interviews with her and a lot of diagnosis of her work. It's super interesting. So she says the totalitarianism is not predictable or inevitable. Like, in hindsight, you can trace the steps that led there, but the steps are always different. And there's not, like, a set of certain things that lead to a totalitarian regime. Yeah. So you don't know if it's going to happen or not. And the totalitarianism is built on terror and ideological fiction. Ideological fiction being, say, Nazism or communism, or in Gilead, the Republic and the Handmaid's Tale, they don't have a name, or Atwood doesn't have a name for the ideology, but it's based in Puritan ideological roots.
Yeah, it's like a Puritan theocracy.
Yeah, exactly. It is different, like I was saying earlier, than a monarchy, because even though both have one kind of supreme leader on top that seems to hold all the cards, monarchies used fear to gain and maintain power, but totalitarianism uses fear to try and control every aspect of people's lives. So this idea of always being watched and that everyone has eyes on you is very specific to a totalitarian
regime.
Yeah, it's a mouthful, and I'm saying it a lot.
So totalitarian.
Yeah, say it three times fast. Like, that's my challenge to everyone who's listening. And they use terror or fear to enforce their ideological beliefs. So, like, say in the Soviet Union, this fear and the secret police were used to enforce communism.
Yeah.
And you couldn't do anything that was deemed, quote-unquote, anti-communist. And the same with fascism, or Nazism, I should say, in Germany.
Yeah.
The political elite sees power in this new government to further their own interests, whether they be personal, ideological, or political. Usually it's all of the above.
Yeah, it's normally a mix.
Or all of them.
Yeah.
And the big tell of totalitarianism is that government expansion reaches further and further and further into people's lives. So it gets to a point where anything that is not sanctioned by the state or by the government is considered illegitimate or against the government.
Yeah.
So I was reading a lot about the Soviet Union's expansion into Eastern Europe after World War II. And if you belonged to any club that the government hadn't sanctioned, you could be a political enemy. So even if you were part of a chess club, if it wasn't state sanctioned,
not the Soviet chess club.
Yeah, you were a political enemy. Yeah, people did too. Yeah. And slowly citizens lose more and more rights. And what Ardent says is that it took away citizens' liberty and uniqueness that had united them before under a democracy. And what is like the killing point is that as soon as the government has control of the press, anything can happen. Because the people are not as informed as they could be. And if you aren't informed, you can't make opinions because you can't think and judge.
Yeah.
And it's not that you necessarily believe everything that you're being told, but you don't believe anything.
Yeah.
And that's something that happens in The Handmaid's Tale a lot, where any kind of information she gets, especially from like
the news
is all government sanctioned, and she's not sure exactly what's happening all the time.
Because it looks like they're winning the war, but she doesn't know. They could be losing it, because of course they're not going to show if they're like losing battles and stuff.
And this sounds pretty horrible, right?
It does.
You wouldn't want to live in that?
No.
I don't think anyone would really want to live in that. So you wonder, how did totalitarian regimes come to power? And why they have to have the support of the masses in some form.
At least at the beginning.
Yeah. And what Ardent says is that the appeal of totalitarian ideologies came from the devastation of once stable societies. Examples are the Eastern Front after World War II, the Depression, World War I. These are the big ones that she cited. And the masses are dissatisfied with their government, and want something from outside the institution.
Yeah.
So they don't trust the current government and their current the current people representing them. They think they're corrupt or inept or probably both. I mean, if you read The Handmaid's Tale, like the syphilis,
yeah.
the crisis of children.
Yeah.
They, of course, like people, you can see how
worried. They didn't have control over what was going on in their country or what, and there was almost chaos, you know.
Yes, and these new governments allow the populace to find blame for their problems. So a very famous example is that in Nazi Germany, the Jews were the cause of all the problems and the homosexuals.
Yeah.
In communism, it kind of just shifted
to the West?
To everyone. like the West, yes. But it just they were always looking for new scapegoats, which is funny because that's not the communist ideology. Is that
yeah, we all should come together.
Peoples can come yeah. together. Yeah. But then they were like, no, it's the Nazis. Well, now we've gotten rid of all the Nazis. Okay, now it's the Jews.
Yeah.
And now it's the West. Like, they kept on shifting the blame.
Yeah.
But you see that in Handmaid's Tale, especially in the book, where, like, at first it was the adulterers and the people who weren't living within the Christian faith. And then it turns yeah. into the homosexuals. And then eventually different religious groups are getting targeted.
Yeah. It's funny you mention that because that's something that you see in 1984 also, George mm-hmm. Orwell's dystopian masterpiece, where he talks, you know, all these countries are always at war. And every now and again, the government will be like, you know what, we're at peace with these guys now. Now we're at war with our old allies. And everyone will say, like, you know, down with that other country
right.
that
it's
you
a,
were just allies with.
It's a way to mobilize the population.
Yeah, and constantly shift blame to different, you know, places.
Right. And this leads me to my next point, where totalitarianism propaganda thrives on escape from reality to fiction, and that it can insult your common sense. But that doesn't even matter because
yeah.
the populace just wants someone to put the blame on, or they want to hear the good things that are going to happen. Totalitarian regimes claim that their ideologies are the key to history, that they can explain the past and secure the present and the future. And it seems to me they rarely do.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like it's ever been very good to live under a totalitarian regime.
No, I mean, North Korea right now, I think, yeah. is the best example of a totalitarian regime.
Venezuela under Chavez had for a while there when they were big on oil money. It's like, oh, it's a great place to live. But once the oil price dropped, now they're screwed and there's riots in the streets and there's food shortages, you know. So if it is good, it doesn't last that long. You know, it's propped up by straws
yeah.
a lot of times.
But anyway, that's my little segment on totalitarianism and how it relates to the book. And now I'm really excited to hear about Margaret Atwood and Handmaid's Tale, Kyle.
Margaret Atwood and Handmaid's Tale. Well, despite this book being so depressing and so like hard, Margaret Atwood is actually like really funny and really quick. And she seems fairly positive about things. Like she's got a fairly positive outlook.
I enjoyed interviews with her.
Yeah,
and
me too.
Especially when she's saying like, could this happen? And she's like, no.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah. So I want to start by going right to the source, author Margaret Atwood, her life and how she came about writing this book. Atwood has a very interesting life. And like we were saying, she's one of the funniest writers I've ever watched interviews. And I feel like she's really quick-witted and she's really dry. And a lot of the interviews I watched her, I watched her on a panel at BookCon where she would make these jokes and it would just, they were quick and they were a little quirky and they would kind of go over the heads of people. I was laughing, but the room was a little silent.
She must be in her 80s, right?
Yeah, she's 77, I think.
Good for her.
Yeah, she has made it a long time, and she's still writing, you know? She's mm-hmm. still quick-witted. She's still there mentally, at least it seems, anyway, from interviews. Atwood was born in Canada in 1939, like Claire mentioned, and she spent most of her formative years living in the wilderness of northern Quebec and later north of Lake Superior. Her father was an entomologist and her mother was a dietitian, and she lived just in the woods with her mom, her dad, and her brother until she was 8 or 9 years old. And she really didn't have much, you know, contact with the outside world, what she called, you know, society, quote unquote. It wasn't until 1948 when her father got an appointment at the University of Toronto that Atwood had to rejoin the quote-unquote society. Specifically, she says, 9-year-old girl society, which was very, very different than
living in the woods.
Than living in the woods
yeah.
with your brother, where you walk around with your pants tucked into your socks so you don't get ticks and stuff.
Yeah, it is.
And she didn't know anything about haircuts or dresses or you know, mm-hmm. what little girls of that time knew about. So Atwood started writing as a teen, and it was also as a teen that she first put her hands on 1984, which we just mentioned, the George Orwell book, which You all should know about it. I'm not going to explain what it is. It's a dystopian. Just know that. Dystopian novel. Atwood has said that she always liked dystopias, but felt that she was just unable to write one.
I did read that, yeah.
Yeah, which is really interesting because she's so prolific.
Well, because she's kind of written one of the dystopian novels now.
Yeah, yeah. She started her career writing poetry, her first published work being a poetry collection entitled The Circle Game, which was in 1966. Her next published work was also her first published novel, and that was entitled The Edible Woman, which was actually written in 1964, so it was written way before it was published. It wasn't published until 1969. And The Edible Woman is a satire about a young woman who has just become engaged to the who she finds is the wrong guy and finds herself unable to eat.
Wow.
Yeah, it seems pretty intense, and I'd like to check out more of her other work because I really enjoyed the book, Handmaid's Tale.
Meaning to read more Atwood since high school, actually. Since I first read Handmaid's Tale, I'm like, oh, I should read more at Margaret Atwood. Yeah. And
she has kind of a poetic way of writing these novels. Like the sentences are beautiful. It's just really, really well written and engrossing. So her first book, The Edible Woman, was hailed as the voice of the new of the. It was at the time the new, but what we would call the second wave of feminism, which was in the late 60s and 70s.
Not new anymore.
Not new anymore. But at the time, her book, that book was hailed as the voice of the new feminist wave that was happening. But she was not very into that praise. She says, quote, I was not in New York where all that kicked off. She's talking about the feminist movement. Mm-hmm. I was in Edmonton, Alberta, where there was no feminist movement and would not be for quite some time. And this quote was from a New Yorker profile, which was published April 17th, 2017, by Rebecca Mead. And being labeled as a feminist writer or even a sci-fi writer are tags Atwood has often resisted. She asked herself at the at a New York Times meeting in March, quote, is The Handmaid's Tale a feminist novel? If you mean a novel in which women are human beings with all the variety of character and behavior that implies and are also interesting and important and what happens to them is crucial to the theme, structure, and plot of the book, then yes.
Yeah, I get what she's saying. It's definitely a sci-fi novel. There's no way you can say that's not a sci-fi novel.
She has another quote about how sci-fi novels are about Martians being blasted from in tin cans to Earth. And it's a reference to War of the Worlds. And she's like, and that could never happen. And I try to make sure my novels are things that could happen. So she is just against those labels.
Well, she hasn't read Anne and Jeff Vandermeer's definition of what sci-fi
is. No, she hasn't.
Which is if it takes place in the future, then it's science fiction.
Yeah. Ursula K. Le Guin, another famous sci-fi author, has said that her definition of sci-fi is essentially what Margaret Atwood's definition of the books she writes are. So, like, Margaret Atwood says she writes speculative fictions about things that might happen. And Ursula K. Le Guin says that's her definition of sci-fi. So you could argue that Margaret Atwood is sci-fi. I'm just saying she doesn't think of herself necessarily as sci-fi or as that much as a feminist writer. She's come more into that that labeling recently as a feminist writer. And that quote that I just read was from a Vox piece published on June 27, 2017 by Constance Grady. Now, when it came to The Handmaid's Tale, Atwood said it was a book that she couldn't get out of her head but kept avoiding trying to write because she thought it would be too implausible of a premise. She's like, people are going to read this book and be like, oh, what a silly premise, that could never happen. But when she tried to start on a different book that proved to be, quote, an utter disaster, she stopped and was like, all right, let me go back and try and write this dystopian novel, her implausible story. Fittingly, the year was 1984 when she decided to sit down and write it, and she was living, as Claire said, in East Germany.
I think she was living in West Germany.
No, you're right, West Germany. East Germany is definitely not where she was living. I wrote that down wrong. That'd be a total... I don't think it would have been published if she was living in East Germany. Atwood is a lover of history, especially military history, and is very well-traveled. She has even been to Afghanistan, I read, which is back in the 70s, because she wanted to see the train on which the English were defeated in the late 19th century when they invaded Afghanistan.
No one can invade Afghanistan.
No one can invade Afghanistan, except for Alexander the Great. That's the moral of the story. So while living in West Berlin and writing The Handmaid's Tale, she traveled into East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Poland. And she actually, from Canada, knew old members of different resistances who lived under the communist bloc and under Nazi Germany, especially old Polish resistance people. And she talked to them a lot about ideas for
the book. You can definitely see that influence in The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah. So she used these travels as well as historical and current events to help form The Handmaid's Tale.
I read an interview where she said she didn't use anything that hadn't already happened.
That's exactly what I was about to say. She wanted to make sure that everything that happened in the book had historical precedence, that everything the totalitarian Gilead regime did had been done in some fashion before in reality. This is also something she explores in the epilogue of The Handmaid's Tale, which I don't want to spoil for those who read it.
It's my favorite part of the book. If you start to read The Handmaid's Tale and you decide that I don't want to finish it, fine, just read the last chapter.
Yeah, I think it's a really beautifully well-written book, and the book is really engaging to me, but the epilogue, I think, is what pushes it into like a higher stratosphere of just great novel.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating. She also says that she has never been one to think, and Claire mentioned this, that it can't happen here, it being a totalitarian takeover, and if it were to happen in America, how would it happen? And she doesn't think that if there is to be a totalitarian takeover of our government, that it's going to be some sort of atheist communist takeover.
I don't think so either.
Which is why, you know, Gilead has this puritanical roots, and it's also, you know, Gilead is the product of the made up time that's going on where babies aren't being born and there's nuclear waste problems and toxic waste problems and mutant syphilis problems.
Listen, that would lead to a totalitarian regime.
Enough to scare anyone into a totalitarian regime.
If you ask me. They can make that better, if they promise.
Yeah. Don't let governments find out. You have, you know, all these governments working on mutant syphilis to get the populace under control. One of the other things I read was that she had all these newspaper clippings. It still exists. Like, they're in a library in Toronto, I think, of stuff related to Handmaid's Tale. But there were newspaper clippings of current events that she was using for The Handmaid's Tale, like Canadian or birth rate dropping and people being worried about that. Or
she just took all the horrible things happening all over the world and put them all into one government.
Yeah. And stuff from history too. Like she was like, what if Puritans came back in a big way and took over the government? Because the Puritan, it's like a 16th, 17th century puritanical religion. It's not religion that Christianity that we would recognize
today.
Well,
it's funny because they quote communist rhetoric, but they put it in a different context.
They put a different spin on
it. So it's godly.
Yeah.
And communism is not godly. It's very anti-God.
Exactly. So The Handmaid's Tale was published in 1985 to almost universal acclaim, and it won the Arthur C. Clarke Award in 1987. And the Arthur C. Clarke Award is for best science fiction published in Britain. So, I mean, the Brits thought she was sci-fi as well, Claire.
Was she British?
No, but it was published in Britain.
Yeah.
I want to move on now and talk a little bit about Bruce Miller, who's the showrunner and one of the writers of the Hulu show, The Handmaid's Tale. Miller first encountered the book when he was in college taking a, quote, new fiction class. So that should tell you about how old he is. and he really liked Offred's character and her sense of self. And it's a book that he came back to many times over the years. Bruce Miller has worked in TV for a while and in a lot of shows that you would know. He was a producer and writer on the science fiction show Eureka, which I've caught a few episodes of, and I thought that was a fun show. Was a producer on a little thing called ER.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, I never heard of that one. No. Is that the one with McDreamy, or is that a different one?
No, that's Grey's Anatomy.
Whatever. All these doctor shows.
I think George Clooney was on ER.
That's right. That's where George Clooney got his start. Clooney. He's so dreamy.
But to move on to The Handmaid's Tale.
All right, so as well as being a producer on ER, he was also a producer and writer on the critically acclaimed show The 100. Which I've wanted to get to. It seems pretty cool. It's also about it's not a dystopian future. It's more of a apocalyptic future, but looks interesting.
Isn't that dystopian?
No, I want to get into this opinions, that what you think the difference between apocalyptic and dystopian is and what I think the difference between them
is. Okay, yeah, let's talk.
So Atwood and Miller worked very closely together on the show, Miller saying that Atwood has so much more experience adapting her book to other mediums, whereas he's never adapted a book for screen. So he was like, look, she's adapted this to be a movie, a play, opera, ballet. Like, I've never done
Girl
a book.
Girl knows what she's
Girl
doing.
Girl knows how to adapt a book, especially her own book. The show is also filmed in Toronto, which a lot of shows and movies are being filmed in Toronto and Canada in general now. But another big reason for this, for The Handmaid's Tale, is that that's where Margaret Atwood lives and thus can have more influence on what goes into the show. She actually has a cameo in it somewhere, which
she's in the first scene.
She's in the first scene?
Not the first scene. It's the first the first episode. I think she's one of the aunts.
Oh, because I didn't know what she looked like when I first started watching the show. So
I didn't know it was her, but I went back, I would be like,
I see.
I read an interview where she talked exactly which scene it was, and I can picture it.
So her and Bruce Miller both make sure that the show doesn't have anything that doesn't have a real life reference, you know, just like the book.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons Miller loves the book so much is the tantalizing open ends of all these different aspects of the world of The Handmaid's Tale, you know, like what it's like under Gilead and what's happening in other parts of the country. And those are avenues he definitely wanted to explore more in the show, which he does, if you've seen the show at all, if you're curious about it. I also want to note that out of the 5 directors for the show, 4 of them are women. So he's trying to make sure this is very female-fronted and led. The Handmaid's Tale has garnered immense critical acclaim for its writing, story, performances, and poignancy in today's time, and has a whopping 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, geez Louise.
TV normally has less reviewers than movies, so mm-hmm. I checked, it's 100% out of 86 reviews, which is still a lot.
It's pretty, yeah.
But whereas, like, you know, when Spider-Man comes out, that'll be out of, you know, 200, 300 reviews. A billion reviews. You know, it'll be a lot. And I wrote down BookCon panel here in my notes. I don't know exactly what I was going to say about it, but... I remember. During research, I watched a BookCon panel with Bruce Miller and Margaret Atwood, and it was BookCon in New York City. This month, a couple weeks ago, that we missed. I was on the West Coast, so there's no way I could have gone. But she did a panel.
I was in Massachusetts, where The Handmaid's Tale takes place.
It was such
Salem,
the
birthplace
of our producer.
I was going to say Puritan roots
and Puritan roots. That's
and
true.
And witchcraft. And James Foley.
And James Foley. He might be a Puritan. We're not sure yet. The jury's still out. So I just wanted to mention that she was in New York and we totally missed her.
We should link to that BookCon panel, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to link to all the articles I referenced and the BookCon panel on our Twitter and our Facebook page. So if for anyone who's curious, they can check it out. Now, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, Claire, you don't think it deserves 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. We've talked about it.
No.
You don't like it very much.
Here's the thing. Like, I acknowledge that it's a really good show. But I dreaded watching it. And full disclosure, I didn't finish it. I got through the 9th episode. And I was also scrambling with doing my research. And I'm hosting a bachelorette party today after we finished recording. So I was getting ready for that as well. But I also had no urge to watch it. I just didn't want to watch it. I love the book. I was the one who sat us all down and insisted that we do The Handmaid's Tale. And then I felt so guilty while watching the show. I know you like the show more than me. I was like, oh, I feel so guilty. I'm making Kyle and James watch this. Like, I don't like this. Anyway, you liked it.
First of all, Claire, watching The Handmaid's Tale while planning a bachelorette party, they go hand in hand. All right.
They really do. I mean, what do you think we're going to do?
Puritanical sex slavery.
What do you think we're going to do with the bachelorette party?
Shenanigans. That just makes sense. They're like peas in a pot.
Really influenced the other. One influences the other.
Second of all, I thoroughly enjoyed this show. I don't want to say loved it, but I liked it a lot. I binged it pretty quick once I started watching it, and I just thought it was really compelling and liked it a lot. And I read half the book, binged almost the entire show, and then read the last half of the book. And I liked the book a lot, too. I thought they were both really good. And I feel like they were fairly complementary of each other.
You know, I guess, and I'm always this person, and I hate myself for being this person.
It's
and
not
I get it
like
from
the
my
book.
Mother. It's not like the book. But I think it lost some of my favorite parts of the book. Like, I love the idea in the book, Offred, the main character, who's played by Elizabeth Moss, is one of the people who is just lost to history. Like,
yeah.
She's someone who won't be remembered, is someone who gets swept up in the regime. And it's Atwood exploring what is it like for people stuck
just
in
day
this... day to day stuck in this regime.
Yeah.
And the show doesn't go in that direction. They make her completely different. But I really loved that this is just a person trying to get through the day who is not a hero.
Yeah.
And I feel like, I mean, obviously, I love fantasy, I love sci-fi, but it's almost always about heroes. That's what we read about, that's what we discuss on the podcast. And I liked that this was just a nobody. And it struck me when I was younger, too, reading it.
Yeah.
And the show loses that. And also, I think that they dealt with race incredibly poorly.
Yeah, I read a lot of critiques to that.
A Vulture article that I'll link to. They just didn't deal with it.
Yeah.
And I heard that, who's the showrunner, Bruce?
Bruce Miller.
Bruce Miller basically said that they didn't think they could do it justice. I think that they would have been better off attempting to do it than not do it at all. Because basically, in The Handmaid's Tale, in the book, race is barely talked about, but it is there.
Yeah.
Like, black people are in...
It's implied that they're sent to colonies.
Yeah, in Detroit, and like, but they're cleansing Detroit.
Yeah,
and
they're sent to like clean up toxic waste.
And the
waste
only
and stuff.
Person who has brown skin is the servant.
Yeah,
and also they talk about the Jews and how all of the Jews are sent to, given the choice to go to Israel because they are the chosen people. And in the show, none of that, they pretend that race has never, it just isn't an issue, that fertility trumps all.
Yeah.
And I firmly believe that in this kind of dystopian government, it would be an issue. And you would be, I mean, it's an issue now. And it wouldn't just go away because this is in the near future. And I don't want to spoil anything, but especially at the end of the book, they talk about how race was something that fueled this new government.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Bruce Miller has been asked about that. And there's a quote from him that I remember reading that he says, it's something along the lines of, is there a difference between depicting like a racist society and having a racist show? Like saying that if it was just all white people, would better?
Because in the show, he's exploring different aspects of the society and they make that a point of the show.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't just have to focus the way he's doing this show. You wouldn't have to just focus on white people.
Yeah. Well, he's trying to make sure that all the storylines, even like you're exploring other aspects, but everything ultimately relates back to Offred, the main character.
Yeah.
So
but
like, I get where he's coming. One of the critiques I read about race in the show is that it's good that there's lots of people of color in the show, and like that's a positive thing that they're present, but that there's no reference to racism ever being a thing in the past or it being a thing presently, and that's a problem for some people. But I feel like if they depicted just a all white dystopia, like that could also be problematic. Like, are you damned if you do and damned if you don't?
I think it would have been better if they did the all white dystopia.
Yeah,
I think. In my opinion, and I don't think that this comes from bad intentions. I think like they're trying to make an inclusive show where everyone, you know, can see themselves depicted. On the other hand, I don't think it's realistic. If you're going to make this realistic show, I don't think it's realistic.
My biggest problem with the show was more about casting. I thought the commander, who's played by Joseph Fiennes, and his wife, who's Serena Joy, who's played by Yvonne Strahovski, we're too young, because in the book it's kind of the ruling class is really old. Yeah, it's older.
And the idea that the old derive their power from the young or mobilize the young and then they sit in power. Yeah, I had a problem with that too.
Yeah.
Also that the wife is really attractive.
Yeah, she's a babe.
And I mean, I guess it makes the point that she's not fertile. She's young and she's not fertile, and that's probably what they were going for. But I like the idea of the older commander.
Yeah.
And also it makes it even more disgusting.
It does. It makes it even more gross. And people had asked at this BookCon panel, people asked Margaret Atwood and Bruce Miller about changes to the show, you know, from the book. And Margaret Atwood actually jumped to his defense a lot, saying like, look, it's a television show. Things had to be changed to make it, you know, to dramatize it more. And so, like, I get that.
I mean,
I'm standing by liking the show. I thought it was...
I think the show is very good. I mean, watch the first episode. It's a sucker punch for sure.
Yeah.
But I think it was also that kind of high tension, just the dread of it. And, they make Offred more of a heroic figure than she is in the book.
Yeah, this is true.
And I really miss that nobodiness to it.
Yeah.
I also miss the relationship to her mother. That was a big part of the book as
well.
Yeah,
that's true.
And it's something that I identified with it when I was in high school reading it as well, that her mother, you know, as a first wave feminist, had put all of her hopes on her daughter.
Yeah.
You know, and then this is where her daughter had ended up.
Yeah.
I thought it was really powerful. And then Offred has a daughter.
Yeah.
And that whole relationship, it moved me a lot when I read it in the book. And I did really miss that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think actually her mother was supposed to be a second wave feminist.
A second wave feminist.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was actually going to tell a funny story. Do you know the reason that I started reading this in high school? I picked it up.
No, why?
We had a list of books that we could read for extra credit, and The Handmaid's Tale was one of them. And I was, I think, 15 or something, and I saw, like, the pretty red dress on the cover, and it said A Handmaid's Tale, and I thought it was, like, some medieval historical fiction. And I was like, I'm going to read Handmaid's Tale. And I had no idea what it was about. But it really did affect me at that age.
Yeah,
it was really scary. And I did not understand all of it. Like, all of the rape, especially. I wasn't quite getting all the nuances.
Yeah.
But it was very affecting. And I think a really great book for me to read at that age.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad I finally read it now. So even if you were feeling bad for making me watch the show, And James, our producer, I'm happy that you made me read this book.
Well, I also felt really guilty because when we had our first meeting, I walked into your house and we were meeting about this show. We were like, how we're going to discuss it. And you were reading The Handmaid's Tale and you looked so disturbed. And you were reading the scene from the ceremony or rape. And you were looked so disturbed. And I felt so guilty.
It was uncomfortable. It's an uncomfortable book, but I think it's one of the top tier dystopian novels, like up there with 1984, Brave New World. Like, this is some of the best dystopian fiction you'll ever read. I could not sell this book more on someone. Like, you should totally read it. And I wanted to actually ask you, Claire, I had a couple things I wanted to ask you. Actually, you know, first, the show was renewed for a second season.
Mm-hmm.
The book has an open-ended ending.
Actually, I also think I would have rather seen this movie version.
Yeah.
Than the book. But anyway, keep going.
The show also has the same open-ended ending. And this is not talking about the epilogue, just the ending of the actual tale.
Right.
What do you think they're going to do for season two? Like,
I think there's a lot they can do. If they're exploring building this world of Gilead, then their possibilities are endless.
Yeah.
Which is why, going back to earlier and race and how it's dealt with, you wouldn't even have to completely address it all in the first season if you had plans for a second season.
Yeah.
There's just so much you could explore.
Yeah. So
also other countries. I mean, you could explore the politics, other countries, how they deal with Gilead.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you a question, Claire. Of all the dystopias you've read, which dystopia would you most want to live in and least want to live in? Because as I was reading The Handmaid's Tale, I was like, wow, this is maybe the worst dystopia. This is the bottom of my list. I would rather live in any other dystopia,
probably. You'd
rather live
in 1984 than this?
I might rather live in 1984 than The Handmaid's Tale.
I mean, it depends who I am.
Those are the bottom two.
It depends who I am. I mean, if I was...
Just as you. Just as Claire.
As me. Well, but what's my status?
Whatever your status would be in these situations.
I mean, if I'm the wife of a commander, then maybe The Handmaid's Tale isn't that bad.
But you can't even read.
Yeah, but 1984 sounds just horrid.
Yeah, but I mean, what if, like, Hunger Games, and which one would you...
Oh, God.
Would you pick the first? Because I know exactly which dystopia I would like.
What would you pick? You just threw this on me. I can't have to think.
Brave New World by
Aldous
Huxley.
Oh, see, I haven't
Huxley.
Read Brave New World.
That is, I mean, it's a dystopia, and it's not perfect, but it's the cushiest one.
I'll post later. I got to think. Now I really want to answer correctly.
What dystopia would you most rather
live in?
Yeah,
and I'm trying to think of all the dystopias that I've read and
Hunger
and
Games. I'm trying to think. Hunger Games,
maybe
Brave
World. I mean, does post-apocalyptic count as dystopian?
That's another thing. What is your definition of post-apocalyptic versus dystopian?
I mean, post-apocalyptic, I think, is post, like, some sort of either natural or man-made disaster and then the ramifications of that and how society has fallen apart.
Yeah.
That's what I think of. That might not be the exact definition.
Yeah.
But I think dystopian is also post-apocalyptic because it's, you know, dystopian can be the ramifications of the apocalypse.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Post-apocalyptic implies that there was some sort of apocalypse,
and then it can be dystopian.
And then a dystopian government can arise out of that.
Yeah.
But The Handmaid's Tale doesn't really have that.
No.
1984
well, I mean, kind
doesn't
of.
Have
like,
that.
That syphilis sounds horrible.
Yeah, but it doesn't. It's not an apocalypse in the world.
Apocalypse to your genitals.
It's apocalypse to your genitals. But like, you know, Mad Max is post-apocalyptic,
you know,
but that is not a dystopia.
Maybe if I could live in the capital in Hunger Games. I would live there.
Until it gets taken over. Isn't it the end of Hunger Games? All the people in the capital have to do their own Hunger Games?
No.
I thought that's what they were going to do to them.
It was an idea tossed around.
Oh, okay. I was thinking in Hunger Games, because I'm from Western Maryland, which is technically Appalachia, I would be in District 12 or wherever that crap one that Katniss is. And
that's
I was
right.
like, definitely don't want to do that.
Well, I think, doesn't California not even exist anymore?
I'm not sure.
I think it like fell into the sea or something.
Well, that
Please.
Sounds awful too.
Yeah. I just wouldn't be here. I mean, call us out. We could be, we need to freshen up on our Hunger Games.
Yeah, I don't quite remember.
But so overall,
I thought I would say watch the show. I really liked it, but definitely read the book if you are a book reader.
Read the book and watch the show if you want to feel really horrible.
Oh, you'll feel horrible.
Yeah.
Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com, and we would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. It really does help our show a lot if we get ratings and reviews on iTunes. So that would just be ducky.
That would be undystopian.
It would be very undystopian. You can find the show on Twitter at DSRAPodcast. I can be found on Twitter at Klex303. That's KLEX303.
I can be found at Along with Claire. That's CLAIRE.
And you can find our producer James at James Fowey Jr. That's James Fowey, FOUHEYJR. You can learn more about The Handmaid's Tale and what we used for our show notes and totalitarianism
governments
on our Facebook page and on our Twitter, where we're going to post the articles we used for our show. Our producer, Commander Fowey, is James Fowey.
He is from Salem.
He is from Salem. Note that. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, who I'm pretty sure would go into a murderous barbarian rage before she was ever taken as a handmaiden.
Yeah.
Things would not happen. And our theme was composed by Off Judy. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you in 2 weeks.